What we're going to do on a Sunday morning through to Easter is we're going to look at the Gospel of Mark together. But this morning is nothing to do with that. So that starts next week. So what's starting this week, today, just for one day only, a New Year special, is just a little reflection on a passage from the Old Testament that had been on my mind for quite a bit. It comes and goes, and I think it's, in a way, quite an important passage, although a bit of an obscure one, so you may or may not be familiar with it. The title that I've given to the talk is What If It Rained? Which, in our current culture, may be, you know, we're very familiar with that. We're quite, we know what to do when it rains. But let me set the context for this. I need to be brief because the children are going to come back in. Back in the Old Testament days, we're way back when, King Ahab was king in Israel. And just across the River Jordan, there was a territory called Ammon, or sons of Midian, Edom. And King Misha and King Ahab had a good relationship. And King Misha used to send King Ahab thousands of sheep every year, like you do, and thousands of fleeces every year as a tribute to him. And that developed a very harmonious relationship between the two nations. So Ahab died, and his son Joram took the throne of Israel up in the north there. And Misha decided that he didn't like the son as much as he'd like the dad, and cut off the supply of sheep. Stopped supplying 1,000 sheep and 1,000 fleeces to Joram. Joram was quite upset by that and took it as a personal snub. I suppose you would, wouldn't you? And he decided that he was going to go to war against Misha. But he felt insufficiently strong to go to war himself. So he sought an ally, and he looked south to King Jehoshaphat of Judah. And he talked to Jehoshaphat and said, "Look, I've been terribly snubbed. I'm feeling very miffed. King Misha has stopped supplying the tributes that he used to send to my father, and I want to go to war against him. Will you help me?" And Jehoshaphat, off the cuff, said, "Yeah, why not? Nothing better to do at the moment. I'll go to war with you against King Misha." And they said, "Which way should we go?" And you can see from the map, if you're into maps and you can work out what's going on here, there was a short way and a long way to go. You could hop across the River Jordan, or you could go right round the Dead Sea. They decided to go the long way round, because they thought, if we go the long way round, we might pick up another king en route, the king of Edom. So Joram travels south, picks up King Jehoshaphat and his armies. They then travel further south and pick up the king of Edom and his armies, and then they turn north to attack Misha from the south. That's the cunning plan. Are you with it? I bet you wish history at school had been this interesting, don't you? But at that point, they hit a problem, because this somewhat hastily assembled task force wasn't brilliantly strategically planned. And they get to the desert region, the wilderness, around that southern fringe of Misha's kingdom, and they run out of water, and they run out of food. We read, after marching for 7 days, just 7 days, they ran out of water, and there was none for the men or the pack animals. And this great army, this great expeditionary force, suddenly hit the buffers, because without water they could go nowhere, obviously. And they hit that moment where you think, things were going so well. Everything was working according to plan, and I've just run out of resources. I've just got nothing left to do the rest of the journey with. Have you ever been there? Probably at the start of the new year, we're still making the plans. This year is going to be different. The gym, the diets, the no alcohol during January. You know, this year is going to be different. The regular 6 o'clock prayer time, I will read through the Bible this year. Whatever it is, I will be nice to my children. Whatever it is that you've decided to do differently this year is still the plan, the strategic plan. Now, I don't want to be a wet blanket, although I'm very good at being a wet blanket, but I suspect that some of those plans may well hit this moment that Joram, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom hit, where suddenly we feel this great plan we've had to make this year different has just run out of resources. I'm feeling dried up. And we ask the question, what have I got to continue? Maybe some of us start the new year there anyway. We never had the big plan. We've had lots of those. We've given up on even making them. We're just going to start from the acceptance that we've got nothing. What have I got? Just an empty box. We're all out of resources. And the encouraging thing about this story, and so many stories in the Bible, is that it seems that when we get to the point where we're all out of resources, that is the very point at which God does his best work. The Bible is full of stories, big stories and small stories, of nations and individuals who get to the point where they've got nothing left. And that seems to be the point at which God does his best work. The big stories of the Old Testament, the story of Israel's escape from Egypt. They had nothing. They were slaves. They were being brutalized by Pharaoh. And that was the moment at which God stepped in and did his best work and delivered them. Later in their history, they're trapped in Babylon. They've been taken captive. Their temple's been destroyed. Their land has been ransacked. They've lost everything they thought they should have as of right as God's people. And suddenly God steps in and does his best work, and they begin to trickle home and to rebuild Jerusalem. Think of all the stories of the life of Jesus, where again and again he met people with nothing, with no friends, with no popularity, with no health, with no food. 5,000 people of them at one point. And God steps in and does his best work when we seem to get to the end of our resources. It'd be nice if he didn't do it that way, I must confess sometimes. It'd be nice if God just kept us constantly topped up like we do the oil in the car, you know. And yeah, let's believe that there is always more. And yet the stories of the Bible encourage us to believe that when we get to the point where we think we've got nothing left, like the Apostle Paul, who said, I've got this terrible thing, Lord, take it away from me, take it away from me, take it away from me. And God says, no, I can't take it away, but my grace is sufficient for you in your weakness. And God does the more when we think we've got nothing left. And God does in this story, but not until they've got really desperate. King Joram exclaimed, we're done for. I like that sort of Fraser moment. We're doomed on the edge of this desert. We're done for, King Joram exclaimed. And you may have seen this image before, but what do you see on the image? Okay, some of you have seen the image before. Many people looking at it for the first time see camels walking across the desert, which is actually true. But really what you're seeing, mostly, is the shadow. The black is the shadow. The camel is just that little sliver of gold on the floor. It's taken from above, obviously. And it looks like there's lots of camels, and they're huge. But in fact, there's quite small camels with very big shadows. And ain't that the way it is sometimes? When we look at life, don't the shadows seem incredibly big sometimes? For the reality that often is very small. One of the words that describes my personality type is the tendency to catastrophize. Have you heard that word before? To catastrophize. In other words, you think of a small thing that could go wrong, and then without ever meaning to, and without ever wanting to, suddenly this thing becomes huge, and it's going to be terrible. And, you know, driving here this morning, thinking, oh, first Sunday in January, there's going to be loads of people away, there'll be no one there, it's not even worth going, you know, and I come and you can't even get everyone in, you know. I catastrophize about everything. I can't stop myself. I wish I could. And incidentally, it's not just me. There are lots of you, I think, who probably share that same view. And things go round and round inside your head, and every time they go round, somehow they pick up. It's like, a bit like rolling a bit of blue tack around the floor. Yeah, every time you roll it, another bit, it picks up a bit more fluff, and it gets bigger and bigger. The kings in this story, they saw the shadows of the enemy. The enemy seemed huge, unassailable. The enemy was the desert. The enemy was the armies across the other side whom they no longer had any resources to fight. They saw the reality, but they saw the shadow, which was much bigger than really, in truth, it actually was, as we'll see. Let's not spend this year, let's try and disappear. Those of us that are like me, and hopefully there aren't too many of us like me, but those of us who tend to see big shadows, the big shadows of the small reality or the small thing, let's maybe spend this year looking at the thing, at least, and not be overwhelmed by the shadow. So how does the story go on? Well, Jehoshaphat said, redeemed, but is there no prophet of the Lord here through whom we may inquire of the Lord? An officer of the king of Israel answered, Elisha, son of Shaphat, is here. He used to pour water on the hands of Elijah. He's got good pedigree. Jehoshaphat said, the word of the Lord is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. Jehoshaphat and Elisha had a certain amount of respect for one another, as we'll see. But Elisha had no respect at all for the king of Moab or the king of Israel. Why should I help you? Elisha said to the king of Israel. It's a friendly prophetic greeting, isn't it? Go and consult those prophets that your father and mother consulted. In other words, pointing to the fact that Israel had been steeped in idolatry for years. If the idols are going to help you, go and talk to them. Don't come and talk to me. No, Joram replied. It's the Lord who's put us three kings at the mercy of the king of Moab. Elisha answered, by the living Lord whom I serve, I swear I would have nothing to do with you if I didn't have respect for your ally, King Jehoshaphat of Judah. Now get me a musician. Exactly what you need when you're in a crisis, isn't it? No water, everyone's dying around you. Put the music on. But of course, that, you know, why do Christians sing so much? And I know some people knock it, but why do we engage in musical worship? Because something about music, something about those rhythms and harmonies carry something of the Spirit of God to us. Music isn't a neutral thing. Music is a God thing. And it can be perverted and twisted and distorted. But music is tapping into the eventual, the very foundational rhythms and harmonies of creation. Somehow it puts us in touch with God. Anyway, I won't go into that. That's another talk. Get me a musician. So as the musician played his harp, the power of the Lord came on Elisha. And he said, this is what the Lord says. Dig ditches all over this dry stream bed. Well, that's going to help, won't it? Dig ditches all over this dry stream bed. Even though you will not see any rain or wind, this stream bed will be filled with water. And you, your livestock, your pack animals will have plenty to drink. And Elisha continued, but this is an easy thing for the Lord to do. He will also give you victory over the Moabites. You will conquer all their beautiful fortified cities. You'll cut down their fruit trees, stop their springs, ruin their fertile fields by covering them with stones. So the remedy to this difficult moment, this life-threatening moment, no water, is simply to dig ditches. To dig ditches. Why would they dig ditches? The only possible reason to dig ditches in an arid wilderness is if you believe in a God who is capable of sending the rain. You cannot do what you need to do to resource yourself for the rest of the journey. But you can prepare yourself to do what only God can do to resource you for the rest of the journey. Do you get it? In one sense, you and I are impotent. We cannot do what we would love to see done. But on the other hand, we're not impotent because we can do what is required to contain what only God can do. Dig ditches all over this dry stream bed. It's not glamorous work, digging ditches. Have you ever dug a ditch? Why don't you dig one soon, and then you'll get a feel of this, the inside feel of this story. Just go home and randomly dig a ditch somewhere. But if you ever dug a ditch, you'll know it's not easy work, particularly when the ground is baked dry. It's hard work. It's routine work. One shovel after another shovel. One shovel after another shovel. No JCBs or mechanical excavators in those days, just doing it by hand. Hard work for nothing. The picture is a little bit misleading because, of course, there was no water flowing. At least the person in the picture on the screen has got the encouragement of seeing the water trickle down the ditch they're digging. They just dug dry ditches. Has your spiritual life ever felt a little like that? Has prayer ever felt a bit like that? Has reading scripture ever felt a bit like that? Has fasting ever felt a bit like that? What's the point? This is just hard work for nothing. There's not even any rain here. Why am I digging this ditch? Why am I worshiping? Why am I attending church? Why am I doing these things? Well, one image that perhaps we can put into our minds from this story is that even if at the moment there is no rain falling, I'm digging a ditch to contain what only God can send. I'm making a space in my life that God in his mercy might choose to fill. Well, what happens? The next morning, at the time of the regular morning sacrifice, water came flowing from the direction of Edom and covered the ground. When the Moabites heard that the three kings had come to attack them, all the men who could bear arms, from the oldest to the youngest, were called out and stationed at the border. When they got up the following morning, the sun was shining on the water, making it look as red as blood. "It's blood," they exclaimed. "The three armies must have fought and killed each other. Let's go and loot their camp." Ha-ha. But when they reached the camp, the Israelites attacked them and drove them back. All they did was dig a ditch. God sent the rain. And remember what the prophecy was from Elisha? The water will be enough for you to drink and for your animals to drink, but also it will be enough to defeat your enemy. Now, they could have sat in HQ back in Israel or Judah planning this moment for years. The strategic planners could have had a field day, flip charts, flow charts, what's it that Mike likes those things? What chart? That'll do. I have no idea what it is, but a Gantt chart, yes. Spreadsheets, what I was trying to think of. Yes, yeah, they could have had all of those. See, I'm working at a very minimal level in this sort of field of technology, so don't think too complicated. They could have planned and planned and planned, and they could never have come up with an idea that why don't we go into the desert, dig some ditches, wait for it to rain, and maybe when the enemy wakes up in the morning, the sun will be at just the right angle to make the water look like blood, so they'll all conclude that we've killed ourselves, then when they come in on us, we'll get them. What a plan! Never could they have planned what God was going to do. Never could they have imagined. What does it say in the New Testament? God is always ready to do immeasurably more than we can ask or think or imagine. Well, how about believing that? How about believing that in 2020? Or trying to believe that a bit more than we believed it in 2019? That we have a God who can do immeasurably more than we can even ask or think or imagine. A God who we cannot plan for, but a God who we can prepare for. The world of difference. I don't want to strategically plan what God's going to do in 2020 because, sack me if you want to, I can't. I can't imagine what he wants to do. I'd love to think that he's going to stir our hearts to be more passionate worshippers. I'd love to think he's going to stir our hearts to share our faith on our front lines. I'd love to think we'll see more people come to faith through Alpha courses and other means. I'd love to think we would be a dynamic worshipping community here in the heart of this community, being salt and light to the whole town and the whole region and every workplace that we touch. I'd love to think that, but can I plan it? No, because it requires a sovereign act of God in all of our hearts. And I cannot plan that for myself or for anybody else. But I do believe I can dig some ditches that might prepare for what only God can do. What would those ditches look like? What would I need to dig out? This is a question for your own reflection. What do I need to dig out just to make space for what only God can do? Maybe it might be digging out some disappointment from past failures, my failures, or perhaps my perception of God failing me. It's really hard to move on into faith when we're carrying burdens of disappointment. Maybe I need to work out, maybe with somebody else, what it means to move on from a place of disappointment in God, where things didn't work out as I'd hoped, and make room for some faith. Maybe I need to dig out some self-sufficiency and make room for a bit of expectancy. You know, we can construct a faith, we can construct a life where we're totally in control, we know how to manage it, we know when to go to church, we know when to talk to our wife, we're in control, we're self-sufficient, we've worked out a life that works and a faith that works. There's no room for God breaking in to do something totally unexpected and perhaps unwanted. There's no room for that. Maybe we need to challenge ourselves. What do it mean for my faith and my life to be a little less self-sufficient? And make a bit more room for the expectancy of what only God can do in my life. I would love a life this year where God does more than I can do. Doesn't need to be a lot more. I'd settle for a little more at this stage. But God, come and do what only you can do. I don't want to be self-sufficient, a self-sufficient faith that looks great from the outside and kind of satisfies me that I'm a Christian. I don't want that. I want something that's about knowing the true and living God and his activity in and around my life. Maybe it's about, for some of us, digging out activism and making more room for prayer. There's one word that I hear over and over again from people who are bewailing the state of their life. It's the word busyness. So busy. I don't know why. So many things going on. I can't spin all the plates. And the first thing that goes, in my experience and observation, when busyness gets a hold, is prayerfulness. It's very hard to sustain busyness and prayerfulness. And yet, if you want to ask me what the one significant ditch that we might dig would be, it would be the ditch of prayer. That seems to me to be what creates the space for God to flow into. So what if it rained? Would we be ready? Would the ditches be dug? Would we be prepared? We can't plan, but we can prepare.